Hello, everyone. It's Matthew DeMello, your host of The Fiona Show, Cross Border Solutions weekly podcast about everything transfer pricing. And today we have a very interesting show for you all. We're talking about a subject that gives even the smoothest taxpayers a huge dose of anxiety. We're talking about audits and everything you might want to know about them, why they happen, how to prevent them, and what to do when they're unavoidable. We have a special guest with us today, Manuel de los Santos from the OECD itself is with us on the line in Paris to provide some special insight. And as always, Mimi Song, Cross Border Solutions Chief Economist, is here to lend her own personal charm. But before we get going on overzealous tax authorities, tax scrutiny, penalties, and adjustments, let's take a look at transfer pricing in the news. Swiss-based multinationals may have lucked out when Switzerland's corporate tax reform failed in 2017, but as of May 19th, the new reform is in, and sorry, but those quote-unquote special tax rates, they're out. Yes, we're aware that those blissfully low and individually negotiated tax breaks likely lured you there in the first place, well, that and along with all the chocolate. But here's the thing. For years, the EU and the OECD have had an eye on Switzerland's unique corporate tax system and the unfair competitive advantages it provides certain, quote-unquote, multinational companies. You know who you are. The new reform, which goes into effect on January 1st, 2020, helps the country avoid the EU's blacklist. Not a bad thing, but it also does away with its biggest corporate draw. Swiss states, or cantons, as they're locally known, won't be able to negotiate preferential tax rates with individual companies anymore. Companies in each canton will all be subject to the same rate. In Geneva, it can be as high as 24.16%. The good news? To soften the blow, cantons will offer patent boxes, which lower tax rates on, well, patents. And research and development will be rewarded, too. You're welcome, Big Pharma. Tax collections from canton status companies are estimated to increase by 2.3 billion Swiss francs, and revenue from companies without those preferential rates will decrease by 4.5 billion Swiss francs. So it is more equitable overall. Still, if the new tax system seems less desirable for your company, let me just remind you, the chocolate will still be there. Are you a tax resident of Belarus? You might be surprised. If you operate in Belarus through a permanent establishment and benefit from Belarus-based income but are located elsewhere, guess where you're paying taxes? Yep, beautiful, sunny Belarus. According to a recent guidance letter, any company that makes money off Belarus must register with Belarusian tax authorities, maintain tax accounting, and keep records of income, expenses, and taxable line items. You'll also have to submit tax returns and required documentation to tax authorities whenever your company is registered. And let me think, there was something else. Oh yeah, pay taxes. Subtlety is overrated, if you ask the European Commission. At least that's what we gather from the watchdog's latest round of economic reports about member states. The Commission recently called six countries onto the carpet and blatantly asked them to step up their efforts to prevent aggressive tax planning. Which countries are in the doghouse? Cyprus, Malta, Hungary, Ireland, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands for now. The move comes in response to criticism that despite noticeable tax leniency on the continent, there isn't a single European country on the EU's list of non-cooperative tax jurisdictions. And you got to admit, that's a little suspicious. The individual reports ask these countries to carefully review, quote, means of outbound payments. The countries have responded to a degree. The Netherlands' new tax reform includes withholding taxes on royalty and interest payments in case of abuse or payments to low tax jurisdictions. Ireland has taken steps to avoid aggressive tax planning, just not enough, as there's still evidence the revenue is escaping. Notional interest deduction regimes and certain tax residency rules are under scrutiny in Malta and Cyprus, and the high level of dividend interest and royalty payments as a percentage of GDP are raising concerns in Luxembourg. Hungary's complicated tax system may be at fault over there, so the Commission's message, simplify, simplify, simplify. Sure, the Commission's direct approach may be unconventional, but it appears effective. While some countries have made more progress than others, all seem to at least be moving in the right direction. In fact, we can't help but wonder, what will the Commission ask for next? Hi, I'm Matthew DeMello, and you may know me as the host of the Fiona Show Cross-Border Solutions Weekly Transfer Pricing Podcast. And while I love to discuss transfer pricing, this podcast isn't the only place you can hear me doing it. Cross-Border Solutions recently relaunched Transfer Pricing University, a live webinar series where you can learn about modern-day transfer pricing, everything from methodologies to comparables to preparing documentation to meet country-specific regulations. Good stuff, I know. Chief Economist Mimi Song leads the sessions. I just ask the occasional obvious question. Since our program is NASBA certified, you can earn one CPE credit for joining each session. Pretty sweet. So what are you waiting for? Join us for Transfer Pricing University every Tuesday and Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern. Classes are free, so now you really have no reason to miss it. Sign up at xbs.ai/TPU. We're always excited about our guests on the Fiona Show, but today even more so than usual. Manuel de los Santos, the tax advisor at the OECD Center for Tax Policy and Administration, I know, what a get, right, has generously offered to share some of his insight on transfer pricing audits, international tax authorities, and those red flags that tell the tax police when something's not quite right. It's fair to say he knows the audit world very well, of course, from his time at the OECD, but also from his firsthand experience working at the Spanish Tax Administration, where he started his career. Building on that huge stepping stone, Manuel moved to the European Commission, where he addressed transfer pricing's role in competition law. And now at the OECD, he's working on a little project you might have heard of called the Tax Challenges of the Digital Economy. Despite being so busy, he's taken some time out for us today. It's great to have you here, Manuel. And with that, I will pass the mic to Mimi.
Hi, Manuel. How are you?
Hi, Mimi. Happy to talk to you.
Happy to talk to you as well. How long have you been with the OECD now?
I've been here for the last 3 years. That looks to me longer than it sounds.
It must be pretty interesting given all the different developments happening at the OECD today.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say I'm obviously enjoying the ride, but it's been quite intense.
Right. Well, it's so nice meeting you. And we're going to just, you know, start off a little bit about learning about your background, yeah. Right? So how did you actually come to work at the OECD?
I think that's a logical step, right? I think I started working in the Spanish tax authorities in 2007, and pretty soon I started focusing myself on international tax transfer pricing. After like maybe 19 years of working on transfer pricing, including a short stage in the European Commission, then I thought like it's just time to try to work from the place, you know, where the policy making is being done. And I think that was my initial idea in order to join the OECD. And luckily I made it. September 2016 was when I started.
Amazing.
And quite happy to have joined for this period. Even at some point it can be said that the BEPS project was over at that time, but I have to say that, you know, the implementation phase of BEPS has been quite challenging, quite interesting from an intellectual point of view. And now we are having real fun with all this digital project, which is quite challenging. It's a nice time to be here at the OECD.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, you might have joined when the BEPS project, air quote, completed or was finished, but there's lots to be done after the initial framework was established, right?
Right.
So, you know, you clearly have a lot of experience from the tax authority perspective. So what is it like working in an international tax governing organization versus when you were at the tax administration?
Yeah, I think the difference is not only about being international, like, it's also, because before when I was working for the tax authorities, you are looking at the transfer pricing stuff from a different perspective, but it's mainly the implementation of the transfer pricing rules, and that's the idea that all the, you know, tax authorities have in mind. Whereas if you move to the OECD, it's more like, or it's closer to the work that, you know, Treasury can be doing, in the sense that you are deciding about designing the policy, the fiscal policy. I think the most challenging thing here is that you are deciding the policy, but not for a single country, but for a big crowd, right? So we have now 130 countries in the inclusive framework, and that's quite challenging to come up with rules that has to be implemented for all those countries at the same time on a consistent basis. And I think that's the main challenging, but at the same time is the most appealing thing. Obviously, you also have other different issues related to that. That is mainly, you know, when you work in an international environment, you have different culture, people with different backgrounds, which is amazingly enriching, but it's also difficult to deal with on a daily basis. So I think when I joined, someone told me, like, you will have a super open-minded after being here for 6 months, and it's completely true. It's it clearly changes your mind and your perception about the issues.
That's amazing. I mean, having to build a lot of consensus across all of those different cultures and personalities, it definitely challenging, but at the same time enlightening.
Yeah,
right?
And I think that's something that's usually overlooked from outside. If you think about the transfer pricing guidelines, I mean, you have to think, or we have to think about it, as a document that is actually written by a committee. I mean, obviously, we in the Secretariat, we are leading the draft, but at the end of the day, every single word, and I really mean every single word, has to be agreed on a consensus basis by those 130 countries.
Yep.
So that's really challenging.
Wow. And besides the digital economy project, I know you had just mentioned that, Manuel. What other current projects are you working on? Or is that enough? That's actually a lot,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, when I joined 2016, I started working on the attribution of profit to the then I also worked on the revision of Chapter 2 of the Transfer Pricing Guidelines about the profit split method, the transactional profit split method. And I think it was like mid-2017 or late 2017, I started leading the project on financial transaction. That is also like a very challenging one that's been amazing in leading that project. And I'm happy to say that we are close to finalization. We are still not done, but we have something very close to final, and we are hoping to have a new chapter of the transfer pricing guidelines released by the end of the year at the latest.
Wow, that's amazing. And, you know, based on all this policy work that's being done at the OECD now, you know, your general thoughts about the current transfer pricing landscape, what do you think has been happening as a result of the BEPS initiative?
Yeah, I think that's related to the first question also about me being part of the OECD at that particular moment. I think we are in really extraordinary times. You know, since the inception of the transfer pricing as we know it, I don't know, in the 1920s, and the reliance on the arm's length principle, and that principle has been governing the cross-border transaction quite well. And now we are in a situation that is it's quite different in the sense that we are starting to have quite a number of jurisdictions that are rising increased level of dissatisfaction related to the outcome of the arm's length principle. And I think that's actually reflected in the program of work that we approved, or the inclusive framework approved, and it was released to the public in late May this year. And then you can see, how, you know, the jurisdictions that form the inclusive framework are asking for a different principle or different ideas to govern the allocation of profits. And I think that dissatisfaction comes from two different ideas. I think the first one is that, you know, the Avalanche principle is failing to deliver the outcome that market jurisdictions are expecting to have, meaning that, you know, they understand that the Avalanche principle is under-allocating profit to market jurisdiction. And I think the other underlying idea is trying to enhance the tax certainty. I mean, it's well known that there are certain areas of transfer pricing that are highly variable and are subject to dispute between transfer pricing authorities and taxpayers. So I think those two points are actually pushing jurisdiction to think about a new framework, a new landscape that it seems to be is going to be quite different from the Outland principle as we know it today.
Right, right. And, you know, I think this is a good segue into our main topic here, which is audit risk and red flags for auditors, because, you know, the idea of getting tax certainty or achieving tax certainty, it's a great idea. Now, we haven't necessarily gotten there quite yet. What are we seeing currently in the audit space today? I don't know if you've been experiencing this, Manuel, or have you heard what's going on in the audit world?
So I think it's very much related. I mean, the landscape we have today in terms of main audits or main topics to be audited in transfer pricing is very much related to the concerns raised by jurisdiction in the context of the digitalization of the economy. So I think it's quite common today having situation where, you know, tax authorities in market jurisdiction are claiming an extra piece of profit to be allocated to the market jurisdiction. And usually, you know, they start with analyzing distribution activities, for instance, or marketing activities. Under our traditional functional analysis, they claim to have the right to tax an extra piece of profit in that market jurisdiction, mainly, you know, under the assumption that the functions undertaken in the market jurisdiction are contributing, for instance, to global marketing intangibles or trademarks or the like. So I think that's the main issue we have today when it comes to the transfer pricing audits. And obviously, it's pretty much related to the point we were discussing before about the digital project. And, you know, one of the things we need to focus and we need to try to sort out in order to provide tax certainty to both sides of the table, let's say, to the tax authorities and the taxpayers.
Right. And to your point, you're talking about jurisdictions perhaps like China that want to, you know, understand the benefit associated with location savings, right? And that's another area or lever that they're able to pull to perhaps increase their taxable income in their local jurisdiction?
Right. I mean, it's not yet a question of singling out countries, but I think it's a general perception that tax authorities in market jurisdiction are finding really hard to draw the line that we have, let's say, between Chapter 1 and Chapter 6 when it comes to that division between intangibles for transfer pricing purposes and those market features that should be considered only as comparability factors. But in practice, we are having, I mean, the feedback we have here at the OECD is that countries are really struggling with that difference or make that difference. And that's one of the tension points that we have on the table in the context of the digitalization of the economy.
Yeah, and that's almost a definitional point in some ways, right? Like what is considered an intangible in one jurisdiction versus another jurisdiction.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what's interesting too is just the number of countries that have increased their transfer pricing or tax examiner staff and examiners related to transfer pricing audits and things of that nature. Manuel, you've seen that many countries are now devoting more resources to this issue, correct?
Yeah, completely correct. And I think, I mean, yeah, from one point of view, it's obvious that it's difficult to imagine a situation where a tax authority it's, you know, auditing an M&E group, and it's not going to have a look at the transfer pricing policy of that group. I mean, you know, the increased importance of cross-border transaction at intra-group level, it's something we can't disregard. I mean, that's obviously a driver of the increased number of audits on transfer pricing that we are facing. But I think the point you are also making is perfectly valid, and it's also related to, you know, tax authorities are becoming more and more fluent, if you like, in terms of transfer pricing analysis, and they are becoming more confident in order to get into the complexities of a transfer pricing audit. And I think that's also part of the reason why we are seeing today an increased number of tax audits on transfer pricing.
And if I could just take one moment from here and ask Fiona. Fiona, can you give us some examples of where we're seeing increased scrutiny?
Greetings, all. Finally, nice to make an appearance on my own show. As far as examples of where we are seeing increased scrutiny, let's turn to my old stomping grounds of the UK, shall we? In the United Kingdom, the HMRC raised nearly £1.7 million from transfer pricing adjustments for the tax year 2017 to 2018, representing an historic high and all from multinational corporations. What's interesting is this is slightly more than the figure raised from the year prior, by just over £50 million, and itself an increase from the year prior by more than 90%. The Financial Times also reported recently that the HMRC thinks that corporations have underpaid 2017-18 taxes by £27.8 billion. They also believe that US multinationals are responsible for 17% of that amount in our increasing investigations.
Canada is also cracking down. They proposed investing $91 million Canadian to tax compliance in 2018's federal budget. Total investment toward improved compliance, they proposed to almost $1.1 billion Canadian since the 2016 federal budget. The CRA created multidisciplinary teams of specialists to address complex and emerging tax issues and also to combat tax avoidance and transfer pricing abuses especially. New IT solutions allow the CRA to assess the compliance risk of the entire large business population annually. The agency reported $194 million Canadian in transfer pricing penalties for the period ending March 31, 2017. Also in 2017, the CRA hired an additional 100 auditors to conduct their transfer pricing investigations. Lastly, average penalties increased from Canadian dollars 3.4 million in 2012 to $15.9 million in 2017. So tough stuff.
In speaking of tough stuff, Mr. Matthew, let's not forget what's been going on in Poland since BEPS. Transfer pricing and aggressive tax planning assessments in Poland increased from 10.7 million Polish zloty in 2015 to 2.3 billion Polish zloty in 2017.
So, Manuel, you know, the spirit of the OECD BEPS Action 13... do you think that the spirit should encompass full transparency across different jurisdictions and countries? Was the intention to create transparency?
Yeah, I think that was one of the main drivers of Action 13, just providing tax authorities in different jurisdictions with the information that they needed to perform an appropriate risk assessment. And I think that on the other side of the issue, it's also to make sure that information is only used for risk assessment purposes and is not used for making any kind of transfer pricing audit or adjustment, directly overlooking the proper transfer pricing analysis. I think it's becoming a game changer for tax authorities, that they feel much more comfortable about having, right, first-hand information from the taxpayers before getting into the audit. And I think it's being used for both purposes, in the sense that it's not just performing a risk assessment in order to capture taxpayers in a given moment, but also to exclude from transfer pricing audits taxpayers that seem to be complying under the standards of the Action 13.
Right. Has the OECD started doing some analysis on the CPC reports that have been submitted, and actually are the OECD monitoring that a little bit in terms of different country usage of the data and how they're looking at it?
Yeah, I mean, CPC report is a minimum standard, and as any minimum standard during the BEPS project, it's subject to this peer review process. So that means that here from the Secretariat, we are leading this peer review exercise, and we are checking out that the information is used for the purpose it's supposed to be used, but also, I think more importantly for taxpayers, that the information is shared in a way that the confidentiality of the data, it's guaranteed for the taxpayers. So, yeah, I mean, we are obviously keeping an eye on that through this peer review process, and also subject to the review of the CBC that we have to undertake in 2020, yeah, so next year.
And to your earlier point, I mean, all of this transparency probably causes an increase in audit and potential audit risk for multinationals who may not have been transparent as they had been before. And many multinationals perhaps manage their transfer pricing policies purely on a unilateral basis, right, as opposed to a bilateral basis, which, you know, changes the perspective in some ways. But for our audience, Emmanuel, what does an audit mean for a multinational company?
Well, I mean, luckily I haven't been on the other side of the table, mm-hmm. but I guess the answer must be quite yeah. a stressful process.
You've been on the good side of the table, right?
When I started doing the work for the tax, I started for the tax authorities at the same time that some of my colleagues from the university started to work as tax auditors, and they were always referring to me to the same story, like, you know, even if like a taxpayer is completely convinced about being fully compliant, whenever you get a notification from tax authorities, well, you get into really stress. I think the main issue for an M&E group when it's being audited is like it's a really resource intense procedure. It's time consuming, and sometimes M&E groups need to produce documentation for the purpose of a tax audit that in the normal course of businesses they would not need to prepare. I think it's also related to the work we are doing currently on the digital project. But if you think about, for instance, segmenting the profit and loss account, and, you know, business line analysis or product line analysis, and, you know, this kind of information that an M&A group can have for internal purposes, it's usually demanded or required for tax authorities in order to, you know, perform the transfer pricing audit. And it's obviously something that M&A groups may need to produce on the spot, in the sense that maybe they don't need that information for commercial purposes. So that adds an extra layer of effort and difficulty to the whole process. And I guess that also, I mean, one of the concerns that M&A groups are voicing to us, it's about the confidentiality and that relation of trust between the tax authorities and the taxpayer. I think it's one of the main difficulties that you can see, depending on certain countries, obviously. But, you know, there are countries where we are having that feeling of tax authorities not having, like, the whole trust of taxpayers in order to disclose the information during tax audits. And I think that's also, like, a very stressy issue for M&A groups.
Yeah, no, definitely. Definitely stressful. Audits are stressful on both sides of the fence. But you mentioned something interesting, yeah. you know, as you're describing that and the segmenting the financials and being prepared for an audit. And most countries, and your experience, you know, you were with France specifically, they require contemporaneous documentation. So when you do... when you do ask for that and submit an IDR, some countries give some lead time, right? But as a tax authority, your expectation, right, is still that report was prepared contemporaneously. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's something we didn't cover in the transfer pricing documentation on Action 14. It's something subject to domestic legislation. And I'm not quite sure about the degree of flexibility of the different tax authorities when it comes to required that documentation. But, I mean, the feeling I have from my previous experience is that obviously that documentation has to be contemporary. And in terms of, the deadline you have to submit that information, my feeling is that tax authorities might be applying that quite strictly based on their domestic law. But as I said, that's something we can't work on because it's based on that domestic legislation.
A global pandemic, a grim economic forecast, feeling the squeeze, an R&D tax credit can help lower your burn. If you qualify, the IRS and some state governments will give you a tax credit equal to 10% of your company's spend on development activities. You can even take the credit against payroll taxes if you're in the red. All you have to do is claim it. So what's stopping you? If an expensive application process is turning you off, sorry, now you really have no excuse. Cross-Border Solutions' AI-driven R&D tax credit software eliminates the need for pricey consultants and allows you to apply for R&D credits all over the world for one low fee. After all, Why should you have to spend your whole R&D tax credit on getting your R&D tax credit? It's your money. Keep more of it with CrossBorder Solutions, the global leader in AI-driven tax solutions. Request a demo today. Visit xbs.ai/RD. That's xbs.ai/RD.
So, how do tax authorities actually pick their targets? Like, what are the main signals that actually are red flags for auditors that basically will trigger them to say, we got to audit that company?
Yeah, I mean, I've been quite out of business of tax auditing for like maybe 5 years, something like that. But I still have the feedback from the different delegates that they come to the OECD, in particular to Working Party 6 on transfer pricing, and they are raising the concerns that they are checking out related to M&E groups. But I mean, before getting into those flags, let's say, I think that's an important factor that is random. So, believe it or not, like, there is an important factor related to the random aspect of this analysis, in the sense that, it's not always driven, I mean, the decision of start an audit is not always driven by a specific fact, but also, you know, this large numbers, rule, sometimes lead to picking up M&E groups or sectors in a random way. But beyond that factor, I think obviously, I mean, there are a number of issues that I think everyone has heard about. Like, for instance, if you go to a business restructuring, that's something that for the last 5-10 years has triggered quite a big number of audits, not only in terms of transfer pricing, but also related to whether that business restructuring could lead to the existence, for instance, for permanent establishment under the dependent agent permanent establishment clause, et cetera, et cetera. Obviously, I think if an M&E group is reporting losses for a long period of time or a number of fiscal periods, that's another issue that usually tax authorities want to check out. I think another important factor is, you know, depending on jurisdiction, but there are quite a number of jurisdictions where at the same time you are filing your corporate tax return, you also need to provide transfer pricing documentation, or at least a summary of that transfer pricing documentation that will be used for risk assessment purposes. And I think that's a crucial aspect where taxpayers need to focus, because if you get that wrong, then of course you're going to be called to explain, and that could also trigger a tax audit. I think, like, also mainly in developing countries, I have the impression that there are a number of tax audits related to intra-group services. And I think the reason for that might be also related to something we were discussing before, like, you know, when you start getting expertise on transfer pricing and you are becoming confident on using the or applying the technicalities of transfer pricing, it seems logical to start with intra-group services, in the sense that it's something that you can audit on isolation from other transfer pricing issues. And it's a good starting point to check out the capabilities of the tax administration to deal with transfer pricing issues. But I think that over all those aspects, today we are facing that situation we were discussing before about tax authorities in market jurisdiction, auditing distribution and marketing arrangements, in order to determine whether those arrangements, or better to say, whether the functionality that Gemini Group is undertaking in the market jurisdiction is contributing somehow to the global value of the Gemini Group and then claiming an extra piece of profit to the market jurisdiction. I think that's kind of a very broad, but I think accurate landscape of the different reasons that could lead to a transfer pricing audit today.
That's very interesting. Fiona, what's another red flag?
In two words, Matt, profit volatility. Now CFOs and tax directors tend to think, of course it's volatile. It's normal given the markets, but the thing is that's not how tax authorities think. Companies who perform the same function year over year should expect to earn the same returns year over year. Situations where there is a high dependency on intercompany transactions and consistent returns are expected because of controlled pricing inside the company, and the profit-based method dictates that a company should earn a routine return. Volatile profits could signal to tax authorities that the company could be manipulating transfer prices.
And you know, we actually contacted the Canadian Revenue Agency, that's the CRA, and we asked them to tell us about Canada's audit process. Here are a few points that they mentioned. When the CRA requests transfer pricing documentation, it does not necessarily mean that an audit will occur. If an audit is initiated, though, the taxpayer will be contacted by the CRA to gather additional information, such as copies of agreements, etc. The CRA may issue queries and request interviews to get a better understanding of the taxpayer's business and the transfer pricing transactions under review. If no issues are identified, the audit is closed and the taxpayer is informed. There are transfer pricing issues. If that is the case, the taxpayer will receive a proposal letter outlining the CRA's position. The taxpayer and the CRA will have many opportunities to discuss this proposal. If the CRA decides to reassess, the taxpayer will receive a notice of reassessment informing them of the agency's final decision. The company under audit has the option to file a notice of objection as well as apply for a mutual agreement procedure with the CRA's Competent Authority Services Division. This division performs negotiations and resolutions of transfer pricing disputes with foreign tax administrations regarding double taxation or taxation not in accordance with Canadian tax treaties.
So, Manuel, earlier you were saying that when a multinational, you know, they provide their snapshot or the description of the intercompany transactions and or the documentation in and of itself, that if the facts and circumstances aren't presented correctly or, you know, in line with the expected results, that could be a problem, right? And that's what triggers an audit, yes?
Yeah, I think that's one of the main issues we are having in the transfer pricing landscape. And I think it's a broader aspect in the sense, or a broader issue in the sense that, you know, transfer pricing has like an important advantage. I would say like a key advantage that at the same time could be one of the most important downsides of the transfer pricing analysis of the Amblin principle. And it's the flexibility of the principle in the sense that, you know, if you go through the transfer pricing guidelines, there are a lot of references to the facts and circumstances analysis. And that's obviously intended to flag the aspect that different businesses will have different value drivers, and then we have different aspects to be checked out when you are doing an audit or when you are, you know, pricing your transactions as a taxpayer in the first stage. But at the same time, since, you know, the final outcome of the transfer pricing analysis derives from the interpretation of those facts and circumstances, that could actually lead to different interpretations on the side of the tax administration or the taxpayer. So again, I think that's very much related to the current work stream we have on the digital project and the discussion we were having before about, you know, in the context of this new stream, the addressing the tax challenges of the digitalization of the economy, one of the main aspects we have to bear in mind is that we need to provide certainty that maybe requires us to go beyond this factual analysis and maybe going for something that could be more formulaic or more prescriptive than what we are used to under the current transfer pricing.
Right, right.
I'm just going to interrupt here quickly with our first CPE word. That word is skeptical, as in tax authorities are very skeptical that multinational companies are paying their fair share of taxes.
I always find our code words embedded in the podcast to be hilarious, Matt.
Not sending any subliminal messages. Yeah. We're just, maybe that's our own anxiety coming out.
So let's recap, right, in terms of a multinational's potential to get audited. Number one, it's actually random. Anyone is at risk, right? That's first and foremost. And if you do get audited, your first line of defense would be your transfer pricing documentation. Yes.
Yeah, I think the transfer pricing documentation is key when you are facing a transfer pricing audit. Obviously, for any tax authority, it's a starting point. It's really a starting point where the tax authorities try to get into the business model, try to get into the understanding what's the M&E group policy, the commercial reasons that drive the M&E group in allocating profit to different jurisdictions in different ways. And then obviously, in order to understand how the M&E group has been pricing those transactions. I think sometimes transfer pricing documentation is presented in a way that, you can have voices saying transfer pricing documentation is like it's something that triggers tax audits. But I would think about transfer pricing documentation in a completely different way, because what I've seen in my practical experience is that if you are able to produce an accurate transfer pricing documentation that is, solid and explanatory, I think that gives a lot of comfort to tax authorities, and it's very much likely you're going to have a successful outcome from the taxpayer's perspective going through the audit with a solid transfer pricing documentation.
Right, and having a document that's actually going to meet all the requirements, the local requirements and the questions that they're asking in up front, as opposed to at a later point in time, right? So,
yeah.
And number two, the other risky area here is clearly companies who are undergoing a lot of business restructurings, right? And that's also an area of potential audit risk. But Manuel, to your point, the documentation should be able to craft the narrative and the business rationalization of why that restructuring took place and how it impacts the value chain on an overall basis,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think that's one of the main points that taxpayers have to bear in mind when they are facing tax authorities. And the first point that it has to be clarified and explained to tax authorities is how the business operates, right? Because tax authorities obviously have the technical expertise when it comes to applying transfer pricing in particular. But it's also obvious that, from the tax authority's perspective, even from the OECD perspective, we lack the knowledge about the business and how the business operates, which are the commercial reasons for a business to operate in a particular way. And I think that's the first aspect that taxpayers would be required to clarify. So the better you explain your business, the better you justify the commercial reasons behind, a business restructuring, for instance, in that particular case we have at hand, the most probable is going to be a positive outcome of the tax audit.
Right. And then third, but definitely not least, that we've, talked about so far is the local jurisdictional perspective on distribution versus marketing tangibles and sort of the characterization of the intercompany transaction, right? And their perspective on what are the key value drivers. But once again, this is also about controlling that narrative and making sure that the taxpayer controls and explains the business. Because, Emmanuel, tell me if this is an incorrect assumption. Tax authorities could have a preconceived notion of what that business does and what the value drivers are, right? And in order for the taxpayer to be able to, present their story correctly, they have to get in front of it and sort of, control that story instead of letting a tax authority, assume.
Yeah, if you think about this type of tax audits related to distribution marketing activities, I think taxpayers and tax authorities are all in agreement when it comes to recognize, if that's the case at hand, that there are, functions, assets, and risks located in the market jurisdiction, and those functions, assets, and risks should be remunerated. I think the main struggle tax authorities and taxpayers have related to that point is that how you assess the importance of those functions, assets, and risk in relationship with the whole value chain of the M&E group. And that's where, you know, the explanation from the taxpayer is really appreciated and really needed in order to really, you know, understand that relative value. Because if the understanding of the tax authorities of the business model leads to the conclusion that those activities happening in the country are contributing to the value brand, then obviously, I mean, the logical consequence would be to reallocate part of the profit to the control transactions to the market jurisdiction. So I think that's why I feel the most important point for taxpayer in those situations is to explain the business, to explain the commercial rationale behind those decisions. And in that way, I guess, like, you know, any kind of prejudice that tax authorities may have could be disappear.
Agreed. And, you know, in this current landscape, right, with the globalization of the digital economy, do you think that there's been an increased focus or even an increased audit risk in any particular industries like technology companies? You know, I would say maybe, gosh, it was like 15 years ago, or even 10, pharmaceuticals were always under the radar, right? But do you think that that focus might have changed recently, Manuel, or what are your thoughts?
I think it might be the external perspective that, you know, tech companies are under the radar for tax authorities. But I guess also it's partially because, you know, the amounts of transfer pricing adjustment in that particular industry, it's quite important. And it's also in the public debate, you know, whether the tech companies are paying or not the first share of taxes. So I think that's why these companies are like on top of the tax debate. But, you know, when you get into the tax authorities risk assessment procedures, I wouldn't say that's like, you know, that's an accurate vision of what tax authorities are doing. I think they are doing much broad audits than pure tech companies.
Okay.
But I guess that, I mean, it's, you know, it's out there like in the public debate. So it's,
yep.
It gets or it captures much more attention than other audits.
Yeah, that's probably
true. I don't think it's gonna. It's been like a particular stress from the tax authorities.
Right, right. But I mean, you know, based on what you're saying, Manuel, then no one's safe, really, right? Everyone's potentially under audit, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's
well, so.
We are all taxpayers.
We are all taxpayers.
So
that's right. There's
point.
Nowhere to hide. So, what are some of the ways that, you know, taxpayers can be more proactive about, you know, not getting audited? I mean, getting audited is, to your point, right? There's lots of potential triggers. But then, once you're selected, perhaps, what are ways that taxpayers can try to be proactive about potentially not getting audited or even under audit, not getting further questioned?
Yeah, I mean, just coming back to that point of the randomly aspect of this process, I think there's something also, there's a small nuance, a little nuance on that in the sense that, you know, taxpayer can obtain certain level of certainty through, for instance, an APA or something related or something similar to that, that could also help to reduce the likelihood of being audited. And I think one of the main concerns that M&E groups have when they are thinking or considering about asking for an APA is that it usually takes a lot of time to get the APA done or agreed with the tax authorities. But if you think about, you know, the time that a tax audit takes to be concluded, I think it's quite worth it to explore, you know, this stream about asking for an APA, getting to an APA, and then that provides you some comfort for a number of periods that the tax authorities are not going to knock on your door to check out if your, you know, controlled transaction is aligned with the answering principle or not. But in any case, I mean, coming to the question you were saying, you were posing, I think once you get into a toxotic, I think the first thing and the main point is to create a sense of confidence and trust with tax authorities, in the sense that the taxpayer has to be ready to disclose, you know, information in order to let tax authorities to understand what is going on and how the controlled transaction, if we are in a transfer pricing world, how that transaction has to be priced. And obviously, I mean, that's easier said than done, because sometimes, you know, tax authorities, or when you want to undertake a transfer pricing audit, tax authorities require information that, as we were saying before, is not readily available for taxpayers, and that requires time and that requires resources to be invested in order to provide the information the tax authorities are requiring. So I think it's a two-side or two-way street. It's like, you know, striking the right balance between what the tax authorities claim in terms of information or documentation to get comfort, but also in sense in terms of what the taxpayer can produce, can reasonably produce, in order to generate that information or to handle that information to the tax authorities. But I guess the overarching idea of all that would be, like, the better you are able to explain your business and the commercial rationale behind the decisions you take in order to enter into the different intra-group transactions, the safer you are going to be when the discussion in front of the tax authorities move to pricing those transactions. Let's say that in the transfer pricing world, we have these two stages. So first we want to understand what is going on, what is the, you know, the control transaction, what we refer to as the delineation of the control transaction, and then you come to the pricing of that transaction. So the better you can explain what is behind the decision taken to enter into that transaction and how it's been pictured, the easier is going to be the discussion during the transfer pricing audit in terms of pricing.
Right. Okay. And what about intercompany agreements? Are intercompany agreements helpful during the audit process? Or I know it's also, you know, necessary, but is it going to, you know, help during an audit at all to have that in place?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I think that's something we were discussing during the BEPS project and, you know, the revision of Chapter 1 of the Transfer Pricing Guidelines. And even if now the new Chapter 1 goes a bit beyond what is in the contract, let's say that, you know, if the conduct of the parties differs from the contract, then, you know, tax authorities may have or may regard to the actual conduct of the parties rather than the contract. But in any case, it's quite clear in the transfer pricing guidelines that intra-group agreements or intercompany agreements are the real starting point of the transfer pricing audit. So in that sense, again, it's something that really provides comfort to tax authorities and somehow sets the framework within the discussion is going to happen. So again, having this documentation well prepared and, you know, having this solid documentation that is explaining what is going on between the related parties, that's really key in order to get a satisfactory answer for the tax authority.
And I am going to interrupt here just very quickly with our second CPE code word. That word is dangerous, as in it's very dangerous to ignore requests from the tax authorities.
That actually supports what you're saying, Manuel, right? So I actually think this has been great, Manuel. Your perspective is phenomenal, and we really appreciate your time. Thank you so much, Manuel. Now I'll hand it back over to Matt.
All right. Thank you.
Note to multinational companies everywhere, if you think the coronavirus has affected your bottom line, take a look at how it's devastated the economies of governments around the world. And where do you think tax authorities will look to make up for all that lost revenue? That's right, your transfer pricing. You can't afford to be non-compliant, but then you probably can't afford to pay for an overpriced consultant who bills by the hour either. Oops, sorry, Big Four. We've got the answer. Cross-Border Solutions AI-powered transfer pricing software keeps you in compliance by preparing accurate, hyper-localized reports that protect you from transfer pricing audits, penalties, and adjustments. And our technology is available for one flat fee, a fraction of what you'd pay a big-name consultant. Again, apologies, Big Four. Stay in compliance and on budget with Cross-Border Solutions AI-driven transfer pricing software. It's no wonder we're the global leader in AI-driven tax solutions. There we go again. I'm so sorry, Big. You know what? Wait, who am I kidding? Sign up for a free demo of Cross-Border Solutions transfer pricing technology today at xbs.ai/tp. That's xbs.ai/tp.
Thank you so much, Manuel. We're actually, what we have time left for is one of my favorite parts of the show. We call this segment What We Want to Know, and here's how it works. We're going to put you in the hot seat and fire a rapid round of questions. Are you ready?
I think so.
That was your first question. That was a trick question. Anyway, here we go. What quality or character trait do you think is the most important for working in an international organization?
Oh, that's an easy one to reply, but a very difficult one to apply. And I think the answer is flexibility. You have to be very flexible. You have to have like a really open mind because you have so many different cultures interacting with you at the same time. And sometimes you realize that you are not talking the same language, and it's not a question of the language in itself. See what I mean? It's not about English or French or whatever. It's about the cultural background behind each of us, and that's the thing for which you have to be really open-minded, in order to make it.
And Manuel, thinking of your biggest mentor, what have you learned from him or her?
I think I have now like two or three people in mind that have been, teaching me different aspects. Obviously, I mean, putting to the side the technicalities of transfer pricing, that is always like really appreciated. But I think, again, like thinking a bit out of the box, while that's difficult to say when you dedicate yourself to tax, it's kind of, a traditional thing. But still, I think it's a very important aspect. Also related to this idea of flexibility in order to get ready to whatever it can come at some point, so not be fixed at all. And I think that feature, for instance, is very important in the landscape we have today with this changing environment where, like things are moving so fast that from one week to another, we have to change our mindset and get ready to the next challenge.
Of course, of course. And what's your coping mechanism for work stress?
I have a very, very easy one. That is, I try to work out every day over lunchtime. So I'm skipping the nice time of lunch with my colleagues, and I'm going to work out. And they think I'm doing that for like a physical reason, but it's not. It's actually a mental one. I think it's the only way I can keep my mind on my shoulders. Because, I mean, you at some point, it's quite an intense time here at the OECD, and it's very challenging, and you need to have some, way of releasing your pressure. And the way I handle that is to work it out, to be honest.
What is your biggest everyday challenge?
That's a good one. I think the biggest challenge we have today, I think, like putting this question in the context of the digital project, that is the main thing we have here at the OECD now, is trying to accommodate two different visions for the project. So we have, let's say, the political point of view about those ideas of, we need to reallocate more profit to market jurisdiction. We need to rebalance the taxing rights. But on the other side, we have the technical point of view of that discussion, and sometimes it's difficult to fix or to fit the technical aspects in the political commitment that has been achieved. So I think that's the main challenge we are facing now, even on a daily basis, is how we can build up something from a technical point of view that is going to deliver the outcome that, like the G20 countries and the Treasury Framework members are going to be happy to have.
Indeed, indeed. People define success in different ways. What would you say is your definition?
Oh, that's also a good one. I think to me, being successful is just try to be better than yesterday. I think that's the standard I have. It's not about making it or not. It's just you look at yourself and you say, like, yesterday I was able to do this, and I reached to this point. Today I'm challenging myself, and I try to get a bit farther. Regardless of whether you make it or not, getting that far, at least you try. And I think that's the way to get yourself moving and to improve. And I think that's my definition of success. It's not a final stage. It's more like a process.
Thank you so much. That was a lot of fun, and what a great show today. Listeners, I hope there's something in there that can help protect you from transfer pricing audits. And if you want to get more great advice about transfer pricing, subscribe to The Fiona Show on iTunes, and we'll fill you in on the latest and greatest every week. And don't forget about our spinoff podcast. Fiona's very busy these days, obviously. The Fiona Show, hot off the press, where we dish on transfer pricing headlines and who's making them every week. This podcast is engineered and co-hosted by yours truly. Marilyn Mitchum-Strom is our executive producer and writes our scripts. Until next time, folks, this is Matthew DeMello, hoping your week and all those that follow are audit-free.